WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
At home in Corona, Long Island, New York,
That's Louis Armstrong and his wife Lucille on one of the hundreds of home audio recordings Armstrong made on his reel-to-reel tape machine. Those audio recordings are now part of the Louis Armstrong archives, along with his 5,000 photographs, 350 pages of autobiographical manuscripts, 85 scrapbooks, and 5 trumpets. My guest Michael Cogswell is the director of the archives and the Louis Armstrong House in Corona, Queens, New York. The house, where Armstrong lived for about the last 30 years of his life, is being made into a museum and is expected to open to the public in 2003. Although many people celebrated Armstrong's centennial last year on July 4th, according to his baptismal certificate, he was born August 4th, 1901, which would make his centennial this Saturday. We invited Michael Cogswell to celebrate with us. Let's start with some music. This is West End Blues, a classic Armstrong Hot 5 recording from 1928. Michael Cogswell, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Let's start with the Louis Armstrong House, which you direct and which is becoming a museum. Why don't you describe the house and the neighborhood that it's in?
In 1943, Louis and his wife, Lucille, purchased a simple frame house in the working-class neighborhood of Corona, Queens, and they lived there for the rest of their lives. Today, the house is a National Historic Landmark and a New York City landmark, and soon it'll be open as a museum.
Describe the interior of the house and what Armstrong was proudest of.
Well, although it's a very simple frame house, sort of an Archie Bunker house, if you will, they did many remarkable things with the inside. For example, they enclosed the front porch and removed some interior walls to make this gigantic living room, this 70-foot-long living room, which they filled with paintings and upholstered furniture. The downstairs bathroom is covered with mirrors. Every inch of the walls and ceiling is covered with mirrors, and all the fixtures are gold-plated and imported from Italy. So they did many fabulous things with the interior of the house.
Why did the Armstrongs live in a working-class neighborhood for the latter part of Armstrong's life when they could have afforded probably to live anywhere?
Well, it's an interesting issue because Louis, when they bought the house, was already a superstar, and they could have lived almost anywhere, perhaps in Beverly Hills, certainly a big estate on the north shore of Long Island. Lucille found the house and purchased it and decorated it without Louis ever having seen it. They were married in 42, and she bought the house in 43. Louis came in off the road. We know this from his own manuscripts. He gave a cab driver an address, "Take me to this house in Queens." They pulled up front. Louis said, "Oh, go on, man. Take me to the address I gave you." The driver said, "No, this is it." So he got out, came up, rang the doorbell. Lucille opened the door. "Welcome home, honey." She had a home-cooked meal on the table. She had the whole place decorated. And he fell in love with it and, as we said, lived there for the rest of his life. In later years, Lucille tried to convince him to look at an estate on Long Island and a townhouse in Upper Manhattan, and he refused to even consider them. He was very comfortable there in the neighborhood. He knew the neighbors. They knew him. He would hang out on the front steps of the house and talk to neighbors. He would walk up the street to 106th Street and Northern Boulevard, Joe's Artistic Barber Shop, get his hair cut, chew the fat with the guys in the barber shop. He had a very comfortable life there, and he cherished it. It was a real refuge for him when he was off the road.
An important part of the Louis Armstrong archives is this huge collection of tapes that he recorded on an old reel-to-reel machine. What kind of things did he record on his reel-to-reel tape machine?
There are more than 650 tapes in the Armstrong collection at the archives. About half of those are simply dubs of LPs and 78s. Lewis would copy his favorite records onto audio tape so that he could listen to them when he was in the hotel room or the dressing room. He had a steamer trunk custom modified to hold his tape decks and turntables, and he used to haul that around with him when he was on the road. You can think of this big getup as like a 1950s Walkman. But he also recorded, the other half of the tapes are spoken word tapes. He would turn his tape recorder on to record when he was hanging out in the dressing room or backstage or wherever. And as a result, we literally have hundreds and hundreds of hours of tape of Lewis and the guys sitting around swapping dirty jokes and band stories and Lewis and Lucille at home and you name it.
He also recorded many memories about his life. Who was he speaking to when he did that? Was he doing that for posterity?
That's a good question. Sometimes he would make tapes as spoken word letters. We know from the tape that he was making the tape for an individual, for example, Max Jones, one of his biographers in England. But other tapes, we have to ask ourselves that question, for whom was he making this? And on one level, he's just playing with his tape recorder. He's having fun with his audio equipment. But on another more profound level, he was making it for us. He was leaving an audio legacy for us.
Well, you've brought some tape excerpts with you. Why don't we listen to one of them? And this is a memory of Louis Armstrong's from his childhood in New Orleans when he came out of the orphan's home. Why don't you summarize what's in this? Because it's just a little bit hard to hear. So I think it would be easier to listen to if we already know what we're listening for.
Mm-hmm. On New Year's Eve, New Year's of 1912, Lewis fired off a pistol in the streets of New Orleans and to celebrate New Year's Eve, and his little buddies were with him. And there was a policeman nearby who saw this. Lewis had been in some minor scrapes with the law before, and he was sentenced to the Colored Waifs Home for Boys in New Orleans. And he spent roughly 18 months there. When he got out, he was released to the custody of his father. Now, Lewis's father had abandoned the family when Lewis was an infant, and he continued to live in New Orleans, but Lewis had had very little contact with him. So the story Lewis is telling is that he's released from the Waifs home, and he goes to live with his father and his father's new wife and their children.
Okay, let's hear Louis Armstrong.
When I came out of the Waifs home, when I came out of the Waves home, I stayed a while with my father, Willie, and his other wife and family. He had another wife named Gertrude, a nice woman. She thought quite a bit about me. She liked me pretty good. And I thought she was nice chick, you know. And I really liked her. She and my father had two boys and a girl, so I stayed with them for a while when I first got out of the Waves home. But I commenced to getting a lonesome, I got lonesome for my mother, Mary Ann. And And, you know, that's her nickname. And my sister, Beatrice, who they call Mama Lucy for nickname. And before I realized it, I was back living with them again and happy as could be in that great big room where the three of us were so happily, and we lived there so happily, so very long.
Lewis's mother was a teenage prostitute when she gave birth to him. Did he ever hold that against her, that she had been a prostitute?
Lewis always spoke of his mother with the deepest and most sincere respect and affection. He dearly loved her, and she was a huge influence on his life. It's funny, Lewis occasionally speaks badly of his father. If you stand back a couple of steps, though, and look at the big picture, what is more likely is that his mother was on the street and was hustling, as Lewis would say, and his father left her, and he was had a very responsible job. He was superintendent in a turpentine factory, which for a black man in turn-of-the-century New Orleans was a good job, and he held that job for many years, and he remarried and raised children with his second wife. So his father apparently was quite stable. But Lewis worshipped his mother, and he did not have strong feelings for his father.
And he writes in his manuscripts that he always felt very comfortable around prostitutes, and in fact his first wife was a prostitute too.
Well, Lewis grew up in a neighborhood of New Orleans that was so rough it was nicknamed the battlefield, and that's the environment Lewis grew up in, is pimps and prostitutes and street people and nightlife people and gamblers, and he loved them all. He always speaks of his childhood in the most glowing terms of what a wonderful childhood he had. He and his mother and sister lived in a little two-room house with a dirt floor, and there was a privy out back, and they were so poor that occasionally Lewis and his sister would go through garbage to find vegetables and so they could cut out the rotten parts and eat what was remaining. But in spite of that type of childhood, Lewis always refers to his childhood with great affection.
My guest is Michael Cogswell, director of the Lewis Armstrong House and Archives. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Michael Cogswell, director of the Lewis Armstrong House and Archives. Let's get back to the tape archives that Armstrong left. As you mentioned, he often put his record collection on tape so that he could travel with the tapes and listen to them. Sometimes he'd tape himself playing along with one of his records. And we're going to hear an example of that. And in fact, he's playing along with a record that he was featured on. Describe the story here.
This tape was recorded backstage or in a dressing room because at the very beginning you can hear a trombone warming up in the background. And what Lewis is doing, he spins on his turntable a 78 that he made with King Oliver back in 1923 called Tears. He says 22 on the tape, but we know it's 23. And then he picks up his trumpet and plays along with it. And meanwhile, he's recording the whole thing.
And what was the role that Joe Oliver played in Armstrong's life?
Joe Oliver was one of the great New Orleans trumpet players, a generation older than Lewis, and he took a liking to little Louis and took him under his wing. He became Lewis's teacher and mentor. And then King Oliver, well, then he was later called King Oliver when he got to Chicago. He went to Chicago and formed a band there, was very successful, and he sent for Lewis Armstrong. So in 1922, Lewis left New Orleans and traveled north to Chicago to join the King Oliver band. And that was a huge step for Lewis, to leave his hometown of New Orleans and go to the big city up north. And it really was the launching of his international career.
Before we hear Armstrong playing trumpet with his own recording, let me just read what it is he says, because what he says is a little hard to make out. So remember, he's introducing his recording Tears that he's going to play with, and he says, "Here's one that's a beautiful thing called Tears, and we made that one for the OK recordings, and as this record plays along, I'm going to noodle a little with it, you know, for old time's sake."
You're now about to hear some of the finest incidents that'll take you way back as far as the year of 1922, when
I, Lou Armstrong, was playing second trumpet with Joe Oliver at Lincoln Garden in Chicago. And also used to write a lot of tunes. Here's one that's a beautiful thing called Tears. And we made that one for the OK Recordings. And as this record play along, I think I'm going to noodle a little with it, you know, for old time's sake. Show you how the trend of recordings and everything has changed. But you'll get a good idea of this record. It's a pretty thing.
It's Louis Armstrong from one of the recordings that he made himself with his reel-to-reel machine. My guest, Michael Cogswell, is the director of the Armstrong House and Archives. How are you dating the tapes that Armstrong recorded?
As a rule, the only way that we can date these tapes is by references on the tape to a current event or recording session or some other indication of when Lewis made the tape. We can look at the manufacturer of the tape, the type of tape it is, and get some evidence that way. But really, Lewis's references on the tape are the only hard evidence we have of when he recorded it.
Armstrong also left a lot of journals. And you have those journals in the Armstrong House and Archives. Let me read you something that he said in one of his journals. And the Jewish family he's referring to here is the Karnofsky family, who we can talk about in a moment. But he says, many kids suffered with hunger because their fathers could have done some honest work for a change. No, they would not do that. It would be too much like right. They'd rather lazy around and gamble, etc. If it wasn't for the nice Jewish people, we would have starved many times. I will love the Jewish people all of my life. The Negroes always wanted pity. They did that in place of going to work. The Negroes always hated the Jewish people, who never harmed anybody, but they stuck together. And by doing that, they had success. Negroes never did stick together, and they never will. They hold too much malice, jealousy, deep down in their heart, for the few Negroes who try. Is that the kind of thing he would have said in public, criticizing African Americans like that?
He would have. We have to put that particular manuscript in context. It's a very powerful passage, and I'm not going to back off and say Lewis didn't mean it. He obviously did. But he wrote that manuscript, and he opens the manuscript by saying this. He is ill in his bed at Beth Israel Hospital. This is about 1969, and he is critically ill. He's in Beth Israel Hospital. So he's not feeling well. He's facing his own mortality. Plus, as he started that manuscript, before that passage that you read, Joe Glazer, his manager from 1935 on, they had made each other rich and famous. Joe Glazer had a stroke, was admitted to the same hospital, and was in a coma just a couple of floors below Lewis. The kindness of Jewish people to Lewis during his lifetime is also a factor in that manuscript. The Karnofskys were a family of Russian Jewish immigrants in New Orleans who took Lewis under their wing and really helped him, took a keen interest in him. Joe Glazer, who he said was critically ill in the hospital, and Lewis's personal physician in Beth Israel Hospital, who was tending to him at that time, was Dr. Gary Zucker. So it's a very difficult time in Lewis's life. In addition to that, we have to put it into the context of the 1960s with the riots and the civil unrest and the assassinations. And so I think all those factors go together to make a context for that passage. That passage does display a bitterness that you don't see in any of Armstrong's other writings or tapes.
Armstrong did have some pretty powerful things to say during the civil rights movement. What are some of the statements he made?
Perhaps the most famous one is when the Little Rock crisis was unfolding. Lewis was out in the boondocks, I think North Dakota, and a local reporter knocked on his door to interview the famous Mr. Armstrong, who's in town. Lewis at that time was watching the television news broadcast about Little Rock, and he let loose with both barrels. He said that President Eisenhower was two-faced and had no guts. He called Governor Orville Faubus an uneducated plowboy. He said, "The way they're treating my people in the South, the government can go to hell." The reporter wrote this up, took it back to his editor. The editor knew exactly what he had and showed it to Lewis, and Lewis approved it, wrote solid at the bottom of the sheet. It got published, it got picked up by the Associated Press, and went out all over the world. So that's the most famous statement Lewis made about civil rights. But in his dressing room tapes and in his manuscripts, you can tell that Lewis, as a rule, felt that he could do more for the civil rights struggle by being Lewis Armstrong, by performing, by knowing his fans, by traveling around the world. And that's the tact he took.
Michael Cogswell directs the Lewis Armstrong House and Archives. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Michael Cogswell, the director of the Lewis Armstrong House and Archives. The house which Armstrong lived in with his wife Lucille for about the last 30 years of his life is being made into a museum, which is expected to open in 2003. The Armstrong Archives, based at Queens College, includes the hundreds of home audio recordings Armstrong made and his autobiographical manuscripts. When we left off, we were talking about what Armstrong had written about race and politics. He also wrote about, you know, his pleasures in his journals, and one of the pleasures that he wrote about was smoking marijuana, which he did from the age of 26 on. And when he started smoking, there weren't any laws against it. He wrote, "It puzzles me to see marijuana connected with narcotics, dope and all that kind of crap. It's actually a shame." He also said that marijuana was 1,000 times better than whiskey. "It's an assistant, a friend, a nice cheap drunk, if you want to call it that. Good for asthma, relaxes your nerves." What else did he have to say about marijuana?
Well, it's true. He was a lifelong pot smoker, and having said that, Lewis was also the consummate professional. He was always on time and ready to play, and one of the most creative people of this century or any other century. He would speak about his pot smoking in his writings and in the tapes, you know, just in casual references. It was no secret that he smoked marijuana. I think one of the most amusing things that comes to mind, there was a biography of Armstrong published that mentioned in passing that Mez Mezro did arrangements for the Lewis Armstrong Orchestra in the 30s. And I and other people read that and said, gee, that doesn't sound right. I mean, Mez Mezro was a part-time clarinet player, but he didn't have the technical facility to do arrangements for a big band. Where on earth did that come from? Well, a couple of years ago, we acquired a copy of an Armstrong letter from the Library of Congress, a letter that Lewis wrote to Mez Mezro in the 1930s. And he says, in essence, "Dear Mez, we're doing a tour of Europe, and I need some arrangements." Now, you have to understand that Mez Mezro was Lewis Armstrong's pot dealer. He says, "Mez, I need some arrangements. I need enough arrangements to last 6 weeks, and I need some really good arrangements, and I'm wiring the money to the American Express office in Paris, and you dig, Daddy, I know you'll understand." So apparently the biographer had seen this letter and not really understood what Lewis was saying.
One of Armstrong's big hits in the mid-50s was Mack the Knife, which is, you know, the Kurt Weill Bertolt Brecht song from the Three Penny Opera. And with Armstrong, it became this big pop hit. There's a recording that he made with Lottie Lenya of the song, and Lenya, by this time, was the widow of Kurt Weill. And she, of course, was in the original production of Three Penny Opera. Her style of singing is much more of a theater music style, not the kind of behind-the-beat jazz style of Armstrong. And on this recording, it seems to be Armstrong's session, and he's coaching her in the kind of rhythm that he wants. And I think it's really fascinating to listen to him control the session and coach Lenya. So I thought we could give this a listen. Anything you want to say about this track?
Well, we have tapes of this in the Armstrong archives. It is fascinating. Lata Lenya has come by this recording session, and Lewis is coaching her on the coda, on the tag, to mack the knife, and she just can't get that final syncopation. And Lewis is so gracious and so patient with her. It's really a great example of these two together.
So here's Armstrong and Lenya, recorded in 1955, just a few months after he recorded his hit, Mack the Knife.
Look at your Suki Tadri.
Jenny Diver.
Look at your Lottie Lenya.
So with Lucy Brown.
Oh, the line forms on the right deals.
Now that Mackie's back in town.
That's all right now. All you gotta do is we straighten that. Now that Mackie's boom. Back in town. Then we'll pick up from there. Now we're straight now.
Good.
See, like this. Down, down, down. See, Mackie's.
That's easy for you.
It's like a phrase.
Now that Mackie's.
No, no, no. Make it eight notes. Get Mackie's. Boom. Back in town.
Good.
Back in town. One, two, three. Like this. As long as you speed this up, you know.
Now that Mackie's. Back in.
No. That's why if you stay it fast, it's still straight. See, because I'm going to start blowing right over here.
Yeah.
Not that Mackie's. Boom. Back in town. One, two, three.
Yeah.
Just, that's it. That's it. Now we go right from the vocal. Come on.
Okay.
Where
you starting from?
Right from the clarinet. Break.
Tell me what he's doing.
Okay. Vocal only.
Oh, the shark has. Well, no, let him make it. Why don't you just start right on the planet break? See all that note out with straight.
Yeah. Okay, Suki Tawdry.
Now that Mac heats, boom.
Suki Tawdry, take two.
All the way. Yeah,
Suki Tawdry.
Oh, the same. Suki Tawdry.
Jenny Diver.
Lottie Lenya.
Oh, sweet Lucy Brown.
Girl, the line forms. On the right, yeah.
Now that Mackie's back in town.
Suki Tawdry, take three.
Louis Armstrong and Lottie Lenya, recorded in 1955. We'll talk more with Michael Cogswell, director of the Louis Armstrong House and Archives, after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Michael Cogswell, director of the Louis Armstrong House and Archives. I want to hear another of the tapes that you brought with you from the archive. Again, this is another tape that Armstrong made himself on his reel-to-reel recording machine. And in this, he's talking about the movie High Society, which he made with Bing Crosby and Frank Sinatra. And Armstrong plays himself in the movie. He's performing for this, you know, big, expensive wedding and the wedding party. Tell us a little bit about the context of this tape we're going to hear.
Lewis has just finished making the motion picture High Society. He was very proud of it. Frank Sinatra, Bing Crosby, Grace Kelly, and so forth. And he really has Lewis has a really featured role in the motion picture. And he's making a tape to tell somebody, I think his manager, Joe Glazer, about making the picture High Society. And he begins to describe the opening scene of High Society, which features the whole band in a bus traveling up to Newport.
Let's hear it.
Now, for the picture, it's just made for us because we open it up with a bus scene. It's a satire on this jazz festival up in Newport. And it seems as though we are in this bus going up there to play for this festival. And as we go up that road among those fine homes, you know what I mean? And that's when I start telling the boys, just think that scenery fast floating by, see? We're now approaching Newport, Rhode Island. We've been for years in variety, but Charlie Knickerbocker, now we going to be in high society. You know, that's one of the things. We're singing among ourselves. That's in the beginning of the picture. And you talking about a bunch of cats, and you know your boys, how they can ham up a thing. You know, all trying to steal that scene. Trouble young mugs so much, folks, I'm telling you. Tell you, even when the director was explaining the scene, he was mugging, listening.
That's Louis Armstrong in one of his own home recordings, talking about the movie High Society. My guest, Michael Cogswell, is the director of the Armstrong House and Archives. It must be an incredible job to oversee thousands of reel-to-reel tapes, plus recordings and books and manuscripts. What's it been like for you in the past few years to go through all of this and discover what's in the manuscripts and what's on the tapes?
Well, I was in a very interesting and a very privileged position. I was hired in 1991 to arrange, preserve, and catalog Louis Armstrong stuff, which had been taken by Queens College from the house and brought to a state-of-the-art archival center on the campus of Queens College. My first day at work was in July 1991, and I walked in to find 72 cartons of materials stacked up willy-nilly, and I had to borrow a pad of paper and a pencil to begin work. And so we really started from ground zero. And it's just been fascinating because you never knew what you were going to find when you opened the next box. Now, 10 years later, thanks to financial support from the Louis Armstrong Educational Foundation and the Save America's Treasures Program, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and many others. The funding has been provided, the staff has been hired, the equipment has been purchased, and things are going full steam ahead out there in Queens.
Do you have a favorite discovery, a moment that was a particularly big, oh, wow, moment for you?
Well, the tape recordings have provided a number of those moments. Louis playing along with Tears was one of them. There is one home-recorded tape, which I didn't bring today, in which Louis and Lucille and a friend are having a discussion in Louis's den, and then the friend leaves to go to work. It's late at night. I think he's a musician. And then Louis and Lucille get into a little marital spat, you know, an old married couple talking about some of their issues. And then Lucille goes to bed, and you can hear Louis walk over to the bar in his den and put some ice in the glass and pour himself a drink and sit in the chair and sip on the drink and rattle the ice and cough and sip on the drink. And that goes on until the tape runs out. So I was the person who originally copied that tape, and never have I felt like such a voyeur until that tape.
Do you work out of the Armstrong House?
I work both at the archives and the house. I've centralized all our business operations at the archives, so I have one phone and one fax and one desk and so forth. But I have a full-time person at the house, and I'm over at the house quite a bit with architects and engineers. Construction will start in early 2002, and the house will open to the public in 2003.
So what, you're renovating the house?
It's mostly conservation and restoration, to replace in kind many of the wall coverings in the house. Some of the fabric on the furniture has faded, and so we're going to replace that with matching fabric. They don't make that fabric anymore, so we go to a company in Chicago that can replicate that fabric. One of the really, really neat things we're doing at the Armstrong House is to incorporate Louis's home-recorded tapes into the historic house tour. In the living room, the dining room, and Louis's den, there'll be a hidden audio system. And the tour guide will bring in the tour group, give them an orientation to the room, and then the tour guide will move a hidden switch, and you'll hear Louis in that room. So when you come to visit Louis's den, you'll hear Louis in his den, visiting with neighbors and visiting with band members. When you go into the dining room, you'll hear recordings of Louis eating a big meal. Pass the biscuits, please.
Sounds great. What were you doing before you were director of the Armstrong House and Archive? What kind of music background do you have?
I dropped out of the University of Virginia in 1973 to play saxophone for a living and did that for 10 years. And I went back to school and fell in love with musicology and libraries and archives and ended up eventually getting a master's in library science and a master's in jazz history. Just before I came to Queens, I was on the staff of the music library at the University of North Texas, which has a great music library and a great jazz collection.
In 2 days, it will be the 100th anniversary of Louis Armstrong's birth. Now, listeners are probably thinking, didn't we celebrate that anniversary last year on July 4th? What's the story about Armstrong's actual birth date? Is it July 4th or August 4th?
Louis himself believed he was born July 4th, 1900, and you'll still see that date in many reference books. However, in 1987, a researcher in New Orleans named Tad Jones discovered a baptismal certificate in the Sacred Heart of Jesus Church that indicates, quite compellingly, that Louis was actually born August 4th, 1901. So we have two birthdays for Louis Armstrong. To complicate matters, a recent edition of the Mississippi Rag reveals that when Louis applied for a Social Security card, the application reads July 4th, 1901. So now we have three dates for Louis Armstrong's birth.
Which do you celebrate? As many as possible?
Yeah, all three, sure.
How are you going to be celebrating Armstrong's birthday on August 4th?
There's going to be a huge Armstrong celebration in New Orleans. It's has grown into four solid days of lectures and concerts and exhibits and second-line parades and you name it. And so I'm lucky enough that I'm participating in some of those events, and so I'm flying down to New Orleans to be there for that weekend.
Well, Michael Cogswell, good luck with your work with the Armstrong House and Archives. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thanks for your interest.
Michael Cogswell directs the Louis Armstrong House and Archives. The Archives are based at Queens College in New York. The Armstrong House in Corona, Queens, is becoming a museum and is expected to open to the public in 2003. Here's Armstrong, recorded in 1931.
New morning as we love along. Blue skies up above, everyone in love. Off the lazy river, how happy we will be. Mama, mama. Oh, up the lazy river, up the lazy river. Every day they live at the party. And the lady be my long life. By the door, you did, but didn't, oh, baby, didn't, oh, you dog. Boy, if I ain't ripping this evening, I hope something. Oh, lady, of the lazy river. River. Oh, you river.
Oh, you dog.
Oh, you river.
Look out there, Charlie Alexander. Swing out there on them irons there, boy.
This is Fresh Air.